Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, I, as a flutist, will be joined by two others. Robert Stallman and Isabelle Chapuis will be doing a live, very briefly rehearsed flute trio performance and talk about why Robert Stallman is in from the East Coast. Well, it's a bunch of master classes and some wonderful concerts ahead. We'll talk about that. Also, John Rubinstein, who is in town for the touring production of Pippin. John made his Broadway debut in the 1972 production and is now joining the revival at the Golden Gate Theater in San Francisco. It's also the first Thursday of the month, which means here on Open Air, we'd like to invite Joshua Cosman on to tell us about the month ahead in classical music. Stay with us. John Rubinstein is an American film, Broadway, and television actor, a composer of film and theater music, and a director in theater and television. He was born in L.A., his mother, a dancer and writer, and his father was the great concert pianist Arthur Rubinstein. John made his Broadway acting debut in 1972 and received a Theater World Award for creating the title role in the musical Pippin, directed by Bob Fosse. Other works include Broadway appearances in Neil Simon's Fools, directed by Mike Nichols, and Herman Wouk's The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, which earned him a Drama Desk nomination. In 1987, he made his off-Broadway debut at the Roundabout Theater as Guildenstern in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Among his many feature films includes The Boys from Brazil opposite Laurence Olivier. This is exhausting just talking about this, John Rubinstein. He received an Emmy Award nomination for his portrayal of Jeff Maitland in the series Family, a role he played for 5 years, co-starred for 2 years with Jack Warden in the series Crazy Like a Fox. In his spare time, I guess, John has composed, orchestrated, and conducted the musical scores for some 5 feature films, including Jeremiah Johnson and The Candidate, as well as for over 150 television films and episodes. He spent 6 years, sort of as a role I have here, but on a national level, as host for the radio program Carnegie Hall Tonight, and recorded over 65 books on audio. It's his 1972 Pippin connection that brings him back to the Bay Area, but rather than starring as Pippin in the current touring production now at the Golden Gate, he's playing the dad role. What an honor and a pleasure to welcome John Rubinstein to Open Air.
Well, thank you so much.
My gosh, so much to talk about, but let's first talk about the reason you're here in Pippin. For those of us that have never seen Pippin or don't know Pippin, can you give us a brief synopsis?
Well, Pippin is basically an everyman story. It's the story of a young man who happens to be the prince, the son of Charlemagne, emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And he has just graduated from university, and he's trying to figure out what to do with his life. He wants to be extraordinary. And his quest is to find some form of activity that will make him and which will feel fulfilling and be extraordinary. And the play takes him through a long journey of frustration and disappointment until he is finally challenged in a very big way at the very end.
Music by Stephen Schwartz. When did this fall in Stephen's oeuvre for composing?
Well, I think Godspell was already a hit on Broadway when Pippin opened. So it was, I'm sure he'd written other sort of smaller things around it, but Pippin was his second Broadway show.
He was here last weekend. I hope you had a chance to catch up with him.
No, I saw him in Denver just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, nice, nice. Did you ever think you'd be coming back to Pippin?
No. No, I did it for 2.5 years back in the early 70s and loved every minute of it, but moved on, and you know,
and
you
on,
grow
and
out
on,
of a part like
say.
That.
Yeah.
I'm too old to play Pippin now. Yeah, yeah. But I never ever thought that I would be back in the play, and I'm just delighted to get the
chance. How did you get back in?
I just happened to be in New York, speaking at my 50th high school graduation. And my agent called me up and said, hey, can you get yourself to New York? And I said, well, I'm here. He said, oh, well, come in on Monday morning and sing for the people at Pippin. So I did.
Neat. So back to the 72 production, how were you first involved in that production? And did it change your New York scene after originating?
Well, I was living in
Broadway
Los Angeles then. I was working in television and starting a family. And by a long sort of story, which I won't bore you with, I had auditioned for Bob Fosse for the movie Cabaret, because there was a moment where Michael York, who played the lead opposite Liza Minnelli, wasn't going to be able to make it. He had a scheduling conflict. So I did a screen test for Bob Fosse, doing my English accent to replace him. Then Michael York fixed his schedule, and that was the end of that. But then, about 8 months later, after they shot Cabaret, Bob just called me at my house and said, hey, can you sing? And I said, well, sort of, not really. He came over to my house. I played the piano. I played Laura Nero songs for him and sang them. And he made me come to New York. And 3 days later, I did, sang for everybody else. And he walked down to the edge of the stage and said, well, the part's yours if you want it.
Neat. Well, speaking of Bob Fosse, you mentioned in one of your interviews that you posit that Pippin hasn't been done as often as other shows because of the impact that Bob Fosse had and the way he directed that show and the subsequent film version of it. What was it about that direction?
Well, he was a very, very creative and specific choreographer and director, and he made Pippin, he put it into a concept which was very much his own. It was Faustian, and it had, you know, very iconic Bob Fosse choreography. It was based on dance. He got the best dancers in New York and told this, you know, sometimes relatively light tale in a very dark and sinister fashion. And the choreography and the way the sets changed were sort of, they made history in some kind of way for theater people. They were sort of unforgettable. And so I think when directors came up against it 10 and 20 and 30 years later, they said, I don't want to just do Fosse all over again, but I don't have a really good idea about what to do different. And Diane Paulus came up with it. She thought of the circus as a background for this show instead of the dance. And that works brilliantly, and that's what we're doing now.
And so the biggest difference in the original production and what's going on now is the more dance element then, or?
It's less dance and all circus. They're acrobats. They're tremendous death-defying tricks that are going on. There's big magic stuff, and there's knife throwing. There's all kinds of activity on the stage that were not in the original production.
Well, now you have to tell me what your aspect of it. Are you on the trapeze?
I'm the knife thrower.
You're the knife thrower.
Fortunately, I stay on the ground. I'm very happy to report. I'm about the only person who does.
We have to talk about your dad. You're the son of the great pianist Arthur Rubinstein, who passed away in 1982. According to the New York Times, one of the greatest pianists of the 20th century.
Well, if it says so in the New York Times, it must be true.
Well, as long as it's not on the Internet. You know, because everything's on the Internet. So you have to tell me what that was like growing up in that kind of a household.
It was fabulous. I mean, mind you, he was my only father, so I don't have a big comparison thing. But he played the piano really, really well. And so in the house, one always heard him playing. And that was a great way to grow up. That's like having great music going on right in the living room all the time. Mm-hmm. And I could go up and interrupt him and talk to him and ask him questions. And he would always, always have answers about why he would phrase something a certain way or why the repeat had to be played in this slightly different way. He was a very, very assiduous student and interpreter of all these composers whom he revered, and he loved bringing them to the audience.
I imagine that's helped you in bringing your own composition when you're writing for scores, for film scores, or
well,
for television.
Sure, yeah. I sat in the orchestras when he was rehearsing you know, concertos and when he was making records. And just by osmosis, I learned how to orchestrate. And that was very helpful.
That hopefully with some music school training as well.
No, never did.
Really?
No.
Wow. So was he very supportive of your foray into Broadway?
Yes, he was supportive always of everything I did. He was less enthusiastic about that than he was about my music writing, which he thought was very cool since he knew I'd never studied it. And he couldn't, for the life of him, figure out how I knew how to orchestrate.
Was he interested in more the style of your writing? He was okay with the film and the TV aspect?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He wasn't hoping you were going to write him a concerto?
Or... Oh, no! My God, no. He would have run screaming in the other direction.
So you're back in town here in San Francisco. You've got quite a connection to San Francisco.
Yes, I love this town. I've worked here a lot. I did a series that took place here, Crazy Like a Fox, with Jack Warden. We were on the streets doing our wild car chases. I think I've shot in every neighborhood in this town. I love it.
Oh, my gosh. What's on your plate after Pippin, then, in the world of TV?
Pippin is my plate at this point. I signed up for a year. We're touring the whole country. We're going to go to Japan. And around this time next year, you can ask me that question, and I hope I'll have an answer. But generally, in my life, I don't. Whoever hires me gets me, and I never know what's coming up next.
And John, and on the composing front, would you ever consider composing a musical? Does that interest you at all?
Yeah, I've written a couple of musicals, but I don't write lyrics. Stephen Schwartz is one of those rare, wonderful, talented guys who can write the music and the words. Sondheim and Cole Porter and, you know, Irving Berlin. There are many who have been able to do it. No, few who have been able to do it well. And the great other ones have always been partners. And I never found a lyricist, I mean, I've written with some great lyricists, but never one that became my partner and that we wrote. So that's one of the big disappointments in my life is I thought I would have written 20 musicals by this point, and I have not.
Well, we do have the original Corner of the Sky from the 1972 version of Pippin. It's not the song you'll be singing in this production.
Certainly not.
But it's certainly going to be lovely to hear you singing this song, Corner of the Sky. John, I wish you a wonderful run and a wonderful rest of the tour. Congratulations.
Yeah, come down to the Golden Gate and see us.
Absolutely.
It's a great show.
It's running through the 19th of October at the Golden Gate Theater on Taylor Street in San Francisco. Information at the Shorenstein website, shnsf.com. Here's John singing Corner of the Sky from the 1972 production of Pippin.
Until I know I'll have it all. So don't ask where I'm going. Just listen when I'm gone, and far away you'll hear me singing softly to the dawn. Rivers belong where they can ramble, eagles belong where they can fly. I've got to be where my spirit can run.
John Rubinstein from the 1972 production of Pippin. Matthew James Thomas, who originated the role of Pippin in the Broadway production Revival, is currently starring in the Pippin role at the Golden Gate Theater now through the 19th of October. And John Rubinstein, a little older now since the 1972 originating role of Pippin, will be playing the father role. Again, you can catch that at the Golden Gate Theater through the 19th of this month. Information at the box office website, shnsf.com. Good afternoon. David Latulippe with you for Open Air, our cultural mix tape of things, all things Bay Area culture considered here on KALW every Thursday afternoon at 1. A reminder that our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. It's a pleasure to welcome two fellow flutists to the air here on KALW. We'll be performing live for you in a little bit, but let me first introduce Robert Stallman, who has intrigued music lovers ever since Jean-Pierre Rampal himself acknowledged his protégé to be one of the most gifted musicians I've ever encountered. According to the London Times, Stallman is no ordinary virtuoso of the flute, though virtuoso he emphatically is. He dazzles because of his penetrating artistry. Bob has collaborated with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center, the Alexander String Quartet, who will be featured this coming Monday for a series with Robert Greenberg. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The Muir, the Orion, the St. Lawrence and St. Peter's Quartets here in the United States, as well as various chamber ensembles throughout the world. For 20 seasons, he directed the Marblehead Summer Music Festival. And every year or so, he winds his way to the West Coast to offer his artistry to young flutists, inspire us all, and in masterclass and in concert. Bob, welcome back to KALW.
Thanks, David. Always wonderful to return.
Well, yeah. This time actually in person rather than over the phone.
Yes, exactly.
I'm glad I could
twist
your arm.
You finally got us here.
Delighted. You are joined by the enchanting Isabelle Chapuis, born in Dijon, France. She studied flute with Rampal as well at the Conservatoire National Supérieur de Musique in Paris, where she was awarded the Premier Prix de Flute and the Premier Prix de Musique de Chambre. I hope I said that right. Did I say that?
C'est parfait.
Oh, my French is... I don't even know how to say bad in French. She moved to California in 1974 and for the past 31 years has served as principal flute of the Orchestra of Opera San Jose. She's performed over 100 operas with Opera San Jose, and this past summer she gave a master class and recital for the Coastal Flutes Festival in San Diego. With her husband, conductor Mark Starr, she is co-musical director of the French Music Festival of the Alliance Française of Silicon Valley. Thank you so much for coming in, Isabelle.
Merci.
I know you're looking forward to the live aspect of this, too.
Oui.
Well, Bob, let's talk about some of the many events that are happening while you're here on the West Coast.
Well, we're right now, the two of us, en route to Sacramento, where I'm giving a recital called, what is it called?
Bach, Budapest
and Beyond. And so it does start with Bach, and it ends up in Georgia, Russia, with a 20th century flute sonata by Taktashvili. In between, there's a wonderful and neglected work, sonata concertante by Friedrich Kuhlau, who is, let's just call him the flutist Beethoven. But he's let's say he's the top of the second drawer. I mean, he's not great, but he's extremely fine and inspired. And that's a sonata in A minor, rather long, large one. Then there's a break, and then I'm doing a Dvorak rondo in D minor that I recreated for flute and piano. It's originally for cello and orchestra. And then the Takhtashvili Sonata, and then Isabel is going to join me for the last piece, which is written in tandem by two flutist brothers, Franz and Karl Doppler, Hungarian flutists, virtuosos. Franz Doppler is the one who wrote most of the flute works for us flutists. As you know, there are many different Hungarian goulash fantasies for flute.
One wonderful showcase.
Yeah, and this is another one. It's called Fantasy on Hungarian Motifs.
Nice, nice. Yeah. Now, you have to tell me, though, that one of the trivia things I know about the Doppler brothers is that they toured with one holding the flute one way and one holding
true.
It the other.
Is that a nice story.
Is that a false?
Yeah, it's not true.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Also, another falsehood is that Kulau played the flute. He never did. But he wrote scads of music for us.
No kidding, yeah.
I mean, you know, the quartet, all the duets, the sonatas. I mean, you'd think he would have had... He played a little bit, but he was not a flutist.
Hmm. Isabel, you have to tell me your connection to Robert. Is it through Rampal or...?
It is. I was at the Paris Conservatory in 1969. That's a long time ago. And I was coming in and Bob was leaving. I was studying with Gaston Crunel, and we met briefly. Then, much later, we reconnected about an article that he wanted me
before that was
to
mean.
Translate for La Flûte Traversière, which is a magazine in France. Mm. And it was all in English, but he wanted me to translate it. I had met him after I had my daughter. I went to Maine. And I saw his name. I said, I have to go. And I heard the most beautiful concert I will always remember. It was in a church.
And she is the most generous-hearted colleague I've ever met. She came up to the stage the moment I finished, and the applause was over. And she told me what she thought. And she was very, very complimentary. And so that's how we met. And then, yes, this article. And then... I think you invited
then
me
Then I invited Robert to San Jose State, where I right. taught for 33 years. And I thought that would be a great thing if people could hear the French flute, not just me, but someone else who has studied with the same professor.
Let's talk about that aspect of flute playing, the French school of flute playing. I mean, it's storied. From study at the conservatory as well. What is it about the French style of flute playing that is different from any other style?
You want me to go first?
I think it's better because I'm so French it's hard for me
prejudiced.
To know.
She might lapse into French at any moment.
Well, look, when they say French school, there really are two branches of the French school. One comes from Marcel Moïse, the great flutist of the early part of the last century.
I think that's my branch because my connection is Moïse through... Bernie Goldberg of
yes.
the Pittsburgh Symphony.
Who's right, he influenced a lot of American flutists.
Yes. Sure. And I studied with him, too.
And the other branch is Rampal's father, Joseph Rampal.
Ah, okay.
And so that's the Marseille branch, that we call the Marseille School of Flute, to make it clear. It's very different, actually. I mean, I won't talk about Moïse because I went to his classes for 2 or 3 days only, and they were very inspiring in lots of ways. But with Rampal and that school, it was basically because Rampal has been gone now for since the year 2000 he died. It's a school based on, let's just say, bel canto singing,
yes,
natural. Light, warm, light, easeful production, and very inflected with feeling, but always in fine taste. And there's this wonderful detail with the articulation. They call it the détaché in French.
Yes.
Very fine. In my days of student, there was nobody else in the world that I knew who could tongue and like a great violinist on the flute the way these French guys were doing it. Not just Rampal, but also his assistant, Alain Marion, who became my teacher also. And not only the speed, but the clarity. And they could do anything. It was like wizardry. So I had to get that. And I had to get that sound, which for me, a great sound is like a great piece of dark chocolate, and you can sink your teeth into it. And that's what I wanted to get. And it took me a while to get some of it. There you go.
Oh, I think that Jean-Pierre was also so natural. And we just listened to him. We had 12 hours a week with him
wow.
at the Conservatoire.
And so that was a combination of class and
where
individual
instruction. Where we were 17 in the class, just always playing the same pieces, the same etudes we had to play. And if he chose you, you had to be ready. And he would come with his perfume, his beautiful everything, and the gold flutes. We didn't have gold flutes, except he did.
Now everybody has them.
And he would just be there, so nice. And if you made a mistake, he would put his arm around your shoulders and say something nice. He was always warm.
It was never.
Always
wasn't a taskmaster.
Nice.
Maybe a taskmaster in terms of repertoire, but never an authoritarian.
Never.
Never negative, unless you were terrible, and then you'd say, "I can't do anything with you."
Well, no.
It was very rare.
I remember bringing an étude three times in a row and thinking, "Well, maybe I can fool him because I'm too busy doing other things." And he looked at me very nicely and says, "Bring another étude next time." That's it. That was it.
Well, we'll talk more after a little bit of playing. Now, this is a very spontaneous aspect of our way of doing open air, in that the host is also going to be playing for you all. Robert, we've got a couple of selections, some Boismontier and some Mozart. Tell us first what we're going to hear.
Well, you're going to join us. Now, I met David. I think you played in a class for me 3 years ago? I can't remember exactly. It's been 3 or 4 years ago in Piedmont.
First, yeah. I believe so.
And I was really impressed, and I always am impressed by your playing, but you played the Lieberman Concerto, I think.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, normally I don't remember these pieces. I have so many people playing
for
me.
I remember this
distinctly.
It was beautiful.
Absolutely stunning. And I said, who is this guy? It turns out you're who you are, and you have the show and all this, but you also have a career as a musician. So David's been trying to get us on the show for a couple of years now. I mean, we did a few telephone interviews, and this worked out. So we're going to venture a few short pieces. Now, the first one is by Bourdin de Beaumontier, who was exact contemporary of Handel and Bach, but in France. And all I know about him is that he must have been a flutist. He wrote scads of flute music, very prolific, and he also wrote in the popular style of the time, which was the Italian style. So there are movements that are French, but also Italian. So I would say the first movement is more of a French movement. It's called Lentement. And the second movement of this trio is more in the Italian concerto style, a la Vivaldi. So the two short movements in G major from a trio sonata that we'll do for you.
Great. And then we'll follow that with a Mozart piece called, it's a trio, arranged for three flutes, but originally for glass harmonica.
Yes. I thought we'd do Das Klingen for two flutes first, which is very short, from the Magic Flute.
Great.
And then you brought in this marvelous arrangement of the glass harmonica adagio in C major for Kerschel 617A, I think it is.
Ah, you know the Kerschel.
So this is the last month of his life he wrote this. It's very special, and it seems to work nicely on flutes.
So live music means you're going to hear us tune up for a moment. You may hear some scattered getting ready as I move from my announcing mic to our performing studio, kind of like our mini Carnegie Hall here at KLW. I think you'll enjoy it. But do bear with us as we prepare for this live performance here on KLW and Open Air.
Thank you.
Music of Boismortier live here on KALW Studios. Robert Stallman, Isabelle Chapuis, and yours truly, David Latulippe, on flute live in the KALW Studios. Robert and Isabelle are next going to perform a duet of Mozart from one of his operas. What is that? What is the opera? Let's see.
Das klingt so ehrlich.
Das klingt so ehrlich. From the Magic Flute. And then we'll talk some more, and we'll have some more Mozart for you. From the Magic Flute, arranged for two flutes. More music of Mozart just ahead. We're going to play from a piece that was originally written for glass harmonica, odd instrument of tuned glasses that was arranged by Livingston Gearhart for three flutes. Actually, one of the very first trios I played back in the day. And Robert and Isabelle have been very kind to do a spontaneous rehearsal in the previous hour to make all of this possible. Trio by Mozart from work for glass harmonica.
Thank you.
music of Mozart here on KLW in a very quickly rehearsed, but I think lovely execution by Robert Stallman, Isabelle Chapuis, and David Latulippe. I feel so French today for some reason.
You are.
Your name is French.
You're so kind to offer to do this live in studio. I know it's a bit different experience doing something live like that.
Especially without rehearsing much at all. But we're in good company.
Not the first time.
Thank you again. Well, you are en route to Sacramento for some master classes. What happens after the
Well, there's a recital Friday night, and then Saturday it's an all-day class, pretty much all day. And then this program that I mentioned earlier, Bach, Budapest and Beyond, I repeat in Berkeley at Trinity Church on the ninth, thank you.
7:30.
Yeah, 7:30, the ninth. And then the next day...
And you're performing with Isabelle on that
Isabelle's
as well?
Isabelle's playing the last piece.
Nice.
And the Doppler fantasy. Yeah.
Yes.
And then the next day there's another class. This is a class in
Fremont.
And I think there are 9 players.
Yes.
It's a big class with a break. I think you're going to play too, aren't you?
I believe so.
Yeah. A pleasure to hear you.
After that, you can see I've got to know what to help
wonderful.
Me on.
So, and then we have another class the following week. What day is that? The
Wednesday, the 15th. Down in San Jose.
San Jose, Valley Christian School. They have a lovely hall up there. And then there is a house concert, which we started doing these in last March. Inviting people into a large home, ideally, of course, with a piano. And then there's wine and desserts or whatever afterwards. And it's very intimate. And so we're going to do this a different program. And this one is called Schubert and His Romantic Influences. And so, of course, it starts with Schubert and it goes to some Mendelssohn and... there's a Reverie and Caprice by Berlioz for flute and piano, originally for violin, and some Chopin waltzes, and it's lighter fare. And then we're going to end the program with Isabelle playing with me. And by the way, my pianist for all this and for some of the classes is Dimitri Kogan, who's a wonderful artist.
Mm-hmm.
And
Frank Johnson, I believe.
And Frank Johnson's doing a very fine... player. He's going to play the class in Fremont. So then we're going to end with this Schubert fantasy by Ernesto Köhler. So maybe he's half Italian, half German. He wrote a number of flute books and duets, as you know. And it's a Schubert, short Schubert fantasy on his Ländler, famous Ländler, which I don't know the name of, but so...
We have to give another shout-out to another local fellow flutist, Diane Gruby, who's been instrumental in helping things out.
She's fabulous, and she's been arranging classes and recitals for me for a number of years.
Well, where can people go to learn about all of these events?
Well, that's a good question. It's on the piece of paper there.
Is there a website, Isabelle, that they can go to?
I'm sorry?
Is there a website people can go to learn more about the concerts themselves? Or?
That's a good question. I think Diane's address is there and phone number.
Me.
Sure. Actually, if you go to trinitychamberconcerts.com, you can learn about the Bach Budapest and Beyond concert in Berkeley on October 9th. We're going to end our segment with you with just a brief recorded excerpt from, I believe, the Rondo. Tell us about what we're going to hear.
This is the last movement of a recreated double concerto of Mozart that I arranged for two flutes and piano originally, and then had my dear friend, who's no longer with us, Stephen Dodson in London, orchestrate, and this was many years ago. And performed it maybe a dozen times, and several times with Isabelle, once in Prague and once here, I remember, in San Jose. Not here, but in San Jose. And it's originally the piano sonata for two pianos in D major, Kerschel 448. It was one of Mozart's favorite pieces for a while in Vienna. He played it with his student, Josefa von Auerhammer, who commissioned it, and Mozart always played second piano. He was very gracious.
Interesting.
But the parts are equal, mm-hmm. as you'll hear. So this is Isabelle Chapuis and myself with the Chamber Orchestra, the Czech Chamber Orchestra of Prague, conducted by Ondřej Kukal.
Isabelle, Robert, thank you for coming in today.
Our pleasure.
Merci.
Merci.
a bit of the Mozart Symphonie Concertante, Kerschel 488. 448. Information for all things that Robert and Isabel are involved in can be found through Lori Lee's website, we just learned. Lori Lee, LORILEE.com. Do try to catch something. Month of October is fast upon us, and we'd like to invite Joshua Cosman on the first Thursday of the month to tell us what's happening in the world of classical music for the month ahead. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, David. Thanks for bringing me on. I always like to come on. October is going to be a busy month for many of us going to the opera and the symphony. That's sort of the main theme of our conversation this afternoon. Starting with the opera, which has a number of very promising-looking offerings this month. Starting with Verdi's opera, Un Ballo in Mosca. I still think of it in the Italian title. They're billing it as a masked ball, for those whose Italian is not quite what it should be. But that's going to open this Saturday night, October 4th, and running through October 22nd. This is one of the great works of Verdi's mature middle period after the early pieces in which he kind of learned how to do what he needed to do and then started putting it into practice. It is a love triangle, as so many of the great Italian operas are. It is set originally in the Royal Court of Stockholm. This is sort of based on a true story and about a king who falls in love with the wife of his second-in-command. The last time they did it at the opera, which was in 2006, I said in my review that you might consider it as being a romance between George W. Bush and Lynn Cheney, if you can imagine that.
I'd rather not,
yeah,
actually.
That was where I ended up as well. But anyway, that's another chapter in American political history.
This is a Verdi opera that's completely off my radar, so I'm looking forward to catching it.
It's absolutely wonderful. So originally it was set in the Royal Court of Stockholm. The Italian censors felt that adultery and murder in a royal court might be a little too dicey for the political scene at the time, and so they made him relocate it to colonial Boston and recast the king as the sort of colonial-era governor, and it doesn't quite work that way. Stuff happens out in the middle of the wilds of Massachusetts that's a little bit funky. But the production now sets it back in Stockholm, as many of them do nowadays. So you've got a love triangle with a king and his married inamorata. And they love each other, but they're not about to act on it, which doesn't really help them because it looks bad no matter what happens, even if you're very conscientious about that.
Well, I do know that there's a lovely first act aria that you're very fond of.
It is. This is a theme that runs through the aria. This is the very opening scene where they're setting their the king with his assistant, with his page. The page Oscar is putting together the invitation list, which is, of course, an important part of any masked, any ball that you, any party you give. They're giving this ball, and he's looking through the list, and he sees that she's going to be on the list, and he suddenly has this moment of excited anticipation that he's going to get to see her at the party. Here we have the late, great Carlo Bergonzi singing the role of Gustavo in the Swedish version that we're going to hear.
All right, from the first act of A Masked Ball, music of Giuseppe Verdi, to prime our pump for the San Francisco Opera production. Then more with Joshua Cosman. From A Masked Ball of Giuseppe Verdi, we just heard Carlo Bergonzi. You'll hear Ramon Vargas singing that role. That recording, by the way, was conducted by Eric Leinsdorf. Who's conducting the San Francisco Opera production?
Nicola Luisotti, our Italian music director. Absolutely.
Be, yes.
So yes, as you say, Ramon Vargas in that role, and Giuliana Di Giacomo, an American soprano whom we do not know, making her company debut as Amelia, which is the love interest, the married love interest. She's married to his second in command, who will be sung by Thomas Hampson for most of the part, and with a couple of performances by the baritone Brian Mulligan, who was a big success here a few seasons back as Nixon in Nixon in China. Also in the cast, we've got Heidi Stober, the great soprano who sang in Showboat this summer. She'll be singing Oscar the Page. And Dolora Zajic is going to be finally back. She was supposed to sing here in Dolores Claiborne, the opera that had been originally written for her. She pulled out. Pat Rosette.
That would have been very interesting.
Patricia Rosette stepped in to rescue that performance. But Dolora Zajic will be back as the fortune teller Ulrika. This is one of her signature kind of, you know, dark, Verdi, scary lady roles, and she does it like no one else.
Those listeners who are fortunate to catch the San Francisco Opera in the Park caught a little bit of Dolora a couple weeks ago.
That's right. So once that's done, then we move on to Handel, which an opera that has never been done here before, Partenope, which opens October 15th, and this is one of those rare birds. This is a comedy by Handel. It's not the only one, but one of the few, and it's the usual sort of romantic roundelay that's far too complicated to understand the plot without many charts and graphs. But it's going to have a terrific cast of Baroque singers, including Daniela Denise and David Daniels, the countertenor, who's been here many times before, and Daniela Mack, the mezzo-soprano, who was an Adler fellow here and then sang here most recently in Barbara of Seville and sort of showed off, as far as I was concerned, a brand new level of stardom. So I'm looking forward to that. You'll notice those are all singers with Daniel somewhere prominently in their name. That's sort of thematic casting, I think. Also, we've got Alex Schrader, Anthony Roth Costanzo, and Philippe Sly, the recent Adler Fellow, filling out the cast. Christopher Alden, who's been here many times, is going to direct that production. He, of course, is going to update the action. So that's going to be set in Paris in the 1920s, which I think will make for some good costuming and some good hijinks and high spirits, we hope. And the conductor is going to be Julian Wachner, an American early music specialist who just came in recently to replace Christian Kernan, who was originally supposed to conduct that production. So that's October 15th through November 2nd. Information on both of those productions is at sfopera.com.
A fun time at the Opera Head.
Yep. Across Grove Street at the Symphony, we have a full helping as well, including a number of good-looking piano events coming. First of all, Garrick Olson, who is not only a terrific and very versatile pianist, but also, I always like to point out, a hometown guy, lives in our city and actually lives not far from me, and I sometimes pass him on the street and think, hey, it's Garrick Olson, look at that. Anyway, he's going to be playing Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto, which has no longer, I think, associated in everyone's mind with the David Helfgott and the movie Shine. It's reclaimed its
standalone glory.
Standalone glory. Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. So he's going to be there on October 10th through 12th. Jurij Valsuha, whose name I don't quite know how to pronounce, but I have to find that out. The Slovakian conductor will be making his debut in that program. Also on that program is music by Bartok, the Miraculous Mandarin, and music by Stephen Stuckey, American composer. He's got a piece called Jeu de Timbre. Then, later in the month, Christian Zacharias, the German conductor and pianist, is finally going to make his symphony debut in that dual role. He's going to conduct the orchestra and be the piano soloist in the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 20. I always love to see conductors who can do that. It's such a juggling act, and it's so impressive when they can pull it off. And then if they can't, then you get irritated with them. But it's always worth a try. That's October 22nd through 24th. The rest of that program looks really interesting as well. There's a Haydn symphony. There's Copland and Morton Feldman, the great American modernist whose music is always very beautiful, very quiet, very still. We're going to hear Madame Press died last week at 90, the orchestral piece. So that's the 22nd, 24th. In between, no pianist, but an interesting program nonetheless. Stéphane Deneuve, the French conductor, will be back to conduct the French violinist Isabelle Faust in Britten's Violin Concerto, a piece that is becoming more and more welcome and common presence on concert programs. Always happy to hear that. That's October 15th to 18th, and as I say, it's all French performers, but no French music on the program. We've got Britten, we've got the Barber Adagio for strings, and Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances. One other thing coming on the program, on the calendar, rather, that is not the San Francisco Symphony itself, but part of the Great Performers series, we're going to have two nights with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, with Vladimir Jurovsky conducting, a very exciting and dynamic conductor. And the pianist Jean-Flam Bavouze is going to be here both nights. This is October 12th and 13th in Davies Hall, sort of a Russian-heavy program, a pair of programs, I should say. Prokofiev Third Piano Concerto, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff Rhapsody on the theme of Paganini, Shostakovich, and just to liven things up, we have a little Dvorak and a little bit of Magnus Lindbergh. So that's October 12th and 13th in Davies Symphony Hall.
All those details at sfsymphony.org.
Exactly so. Also this month, Nicholas McGeegan and the Philharmonia Baroque start their new season together, 30-something years of doing this, and joined for this concert by the cellist Stephen Isserles, who's going to be performing not one, but two cello concertos with the orchestra, one by Boccherini, one by C.P.E. Bach. That's a season-opening program done all around the Bay Area on October 8th through the 12th in different locations. Information on that is at philharmoniabaroque.org. And finally, tonight, we're going to start the season for the Berklee Symphony Orchestra. I know that's an important one for you guys here.
It is indeed. We are broadcasting the entire season once it's over in May. We'll have a full month of Berklee Symphony broadcasts coming up.
Good. So by that time, we'll know how it went.
We will indeed.
Right now, we're just looking forward to it. Joana Carneiro is leading off the season with a world premiere by the composer Oscar Bettison. I don't know a lot of his music, but what little of it I have heard has been quite exciting and witty and imaginative and inventive. So I'm very greatly looking forward to this. Also, the violinist Jennifer Coe, who's always a favorite of mine, both for her performances of contemporary music and standard repertoire. This time she's going to be playing the Sibelius Violin Concerto. I'm pretty sure the last time we heard her on the stage of Zellerbach Hall in Berklee was in Einstein on the Beach. She played the title role. This time Sibelius, and also we've got the Enigma Variations. That's tonight at 7 o'clock in Berklee. And the information there is berkleesymphony.org. But I guess if I don't have the money to buy a ticket, what do I do, David?
Well, actually, funny you should ask, Joshua, because we're going to give away some tickets to tonight's 7 p.m. Berklee Symphony performance. If you call 415-841-4134, 841-4134, we have several pairs of tickets for tonight's 7 p.m. concert of the Berklee Symphony under the direction of Joana Carneiro. Call now. And we'll listen to a little bit of this earlier mentioned C.P.E. Bach. Here's the cello concerto in A major that you'll hear with the Philharmonia Baroque. As you call for tickets for the Berklee Symphony, again, the number 415-841-4134. Operators are standing by. And that about does it for this week's edition of Open Air. Thanks again to Neil Swinkles for herding cats and generally producing and keeping our calendar straight. Also to Eric Wayne for a microphone suggestion for our live flute performance by Isabel Chapuis and Robert Stallman. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at kalw.org.